Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Kirk to Enterprise.
Once the asteroid has been diverted...
That may be hours from now.
In that case, everyone on this planet will die, including the captain.
Lock all phases on that mark.
You lost for us, you lost for that planet, you lost for Jim.
We are your people. We've been waiting for you to come to us.
I say he must prove he is a god.
Many things are strange to me.
Miramani, come here.
I bear your child.
I cannot permit this joining.
You are a god.
Fire! Get up!
There's the false one!
No! No!
Well, it was June the 11th, 1968, a Tuesday, by all accounts, that filming started on this third season episode of Star Trek, the original series, of course, The Paradise Syndrome. Apparently, the two top movies in America at the time were 2001 A Space Odyssey and Bandolero, which featured Dean Martin and Raquel Welch. Of course, 2001 A Space Odyssey also features a monolith. Maybe, just maybe, there's a connection between the monolith and, of course, the obelisk, which we see has musical notes. However, enough of such meanderings and speculation. Let's turn to our resident Trek expert, of course, all series, but particularly the classic and, of course, Next Generation, Larry Nemechek. How are you, Larry?
I'm doing well, Alex. So this is, yes, we're in our right paradise here, third season.
And there is an echo, of course, with another Paradise episode we looked at earlier in the Resonance Rewind run, which, of course, is this side of Paradise. Mm-hmm. The mirror image, not the Miramani image, of course, being that in this side of Paradise, Kirk is the only one who effectively resists, to a large extent, the drive to Shangri-La, to this peaceful existence. Here, of course, he is the only one who succumbs to it. Meanwhile, the rest of the crew have to cope with Ma Pure Wee Bairns and all sorts of other aspects with the Vulcan in charge over a period of 3 months. I think the only part of the original series which effectively shows that long scope of time, 3 months or 60-odd days, which allows, obviously, believability to come into Kirk's relationship with Miramani.
Right. Well, it's, yes. Well, there's a lot of unique aspects to this episode. As far as the story and some of the background bits and pieces that I love to get into and the filming. I mean, number one, the original, here's a good thing. We talk about PC days and maybe looking back and we wince a little bit. Some of the, as futuristic and as diversified as Star Trek tried to be, you know, progressive in the 60s, the original title of this episode was The Pale Face, but that was changed early on. So that's good. But there's a little bit of that whole relationship to, yeah, the lost world, the Shangri-La, only this case it's being ensconced in a generic amalgamation of American Indian Native tribes that don't really... I love looking at the village on the beach at Miramani's village, and you have long huts, and you have some teepees, and you have some round huts, and... But anyway, it's one of those, it's might as well having the Roman planet and the Nazi planet. It's one of those 60s, you know, we got it off the rental truck and on location is like that. Like, I'm still blown away the fact that they did shoot this on location. So good for them. Spent the money and that they built that obelisk, which is a huge set piece.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly the whole connection with historical tribes, Shangri-La and so on. I mean, I know there's an episode we haven't looked at as yet, and it'd be interesting when we do get round to the Omega Glory, where that actually works. This, of course, was written by Margaret Armon, and it was her second episode, I believe, after the Gamesters of Triskelion. And arguably, again, in both Gamesters of Triskelion and The Paradise Syndrome, we have a naive female, a somewhat naive, innocent female who effectively falls for Kirk. Of course, the difference here being that Kirk, because he's lost his memory, falls arguably far more head over heels in love with Miramani than he did for Edith Keeler, obviously back in season one.
Yes. As Star Trek has lasted over the decades, and I feel like there's been a pendulum swing going back and forth on the original series, and we can't help that because the times change. And the original series was the end-all be-all, and then it became, you know, yesterday's old chopped liver when The Next Generation was at its height, and then when the Berman era of series ran their course, suddenly the original series was retro-cool again, and that led to J.J. Abrams setting his alternate universe at least at that same time. And now we've come full circle back around to people are being very critical, especially younger viewers, and looking at, you know, all the problematic aspects of the 60s, not so much the uplifting aspirational parts, and maybe losing some of the context and some of this, you know, treatment of American Indians as all that. But the womanizing of Kirk, and I don't want to defend that, but people send it. We look at that Kirk's women, you know, and people can do a 50 face poster, you know, but if you think about it, what you just said, Edith Keeler, Miramani here in another guy, he's in another life. He's in his own kind of inner light. Picard would have light, although not as long, but still 3 months. And then of all things, Raina Kopec, the android. But if you get away from, aside from, that's one a year, one a season. Okay, one and then two a season.
As many, arguably, as Mr. Spock had, actually, if you take out Amok Time and, of course, the Romulan commander in the Enterprise incident. And again, the nurse Christine Chapel, et cetera. In fact, arguably, Spock was probably more voracious in his female connections.
But all of the other clenches that people love to, you know, run the clip show up, those were all strategic and tactical, right? Mm. It was a little bit of a James Bondian, you know, James Wild Wild West 60s way out of the fit, but they were all strategic and tactical moves. They weren't personal to him. And if he, you know, so this, I think in the context of the way it was shot and filmed still, and then, you know, Kirk matures through the movies and we even get to the point in Star Trek IV where he flirts with Jillian a little bit and she says, okay, space cowboy, it's fine, I have my own life, thank you. And he's like, oh. And they even play with that meme a little bit, but really most of that is, I think, is undeserved. It's just Kirk being the strategian in the moment, and these are the only really three. Maybe there's another one lingering,
excluding maybe Carol Marcus, because obviously Carol Marcus is the one that got away.
And that was as a youth, and that was not on screen, part of a mission on screen as a matured, you know, captain. That was part of, you know, early days.
I have consistently received goosebumps in this episode because it was, for me, always one of the finest Fred Freiberger series productions, because obviously at this stage, Freiberger had taken over the show. He had not quite cultivated the line of being the show killer, which he would subsequently get when he came on board Space 1999 and so on. But I did feel that the sharp ending and that emotive death scene with Miramani was extremely well executed, coupled with a really wonderful musical motif that I think really addressed a whole range of things about this. Also, I have to say that as a teenager watching the episode, I did identify with Spock's dedication to duty and the fact that even when he's told to rest, he still gets up, he still continues that obsession. And you do have that tension between, obviously, Kirk, who for at least 3 months is free from the stresses, the anxieties, the weight of command on his shoulders. The line which we talked about in The Naked Time, where for once, the ship she gives, she takes, no beach to walk on, etc. Here he has a beach to walk on. And apart from obviously Salish and one or two issues with respect to that, and a god who bleeds and so on, he kind of has that momentary fleeting aspect of happiness, whereas, of course, Spock and the rest of the crew have to literally, in the words of Montgomery Scott, carry on until the engines are a puddle of mud, basically.
Right. Well, that's, you know, it's the classic Star Trek format where there's, you know, sometimes there's a planetary, wherever the main thrust of the story is, then you have the B story. Sometimes that's on one planet, and especially in the Next Generation days, the ship's diverted to go help. There's an asteroid crashing into a planet or a moon, or there's radioactive waste that has to be ejected. You know, there's some task that has to be f- fulfilled while the main action, and that also creates the jeopardy of being away from the ship. And in this case, the A and the B plot, they fit together, that they take care of each other, and you've got everyone else doing the shipboard scenes while basically it's a tour de force for Shatner on the planet, aside from the opening and the ending. But it gets a little tropey there with when it falls into the how are we going to depict the American Indians? And Star Trek did, and they did the same thing in Next Generation, sadly, 20 years later, in the Native American show dealing with the roots of what were going to be the Maquis and the Demilitarized Zone. I know I'm skipping shows on you here, but at that case, Ron Moore had researched the Navajo and the whole thing with the dream tent and the Kachinka dolls and all that. And they had a charlatan who had been passing himself off as a Native American expert and consultant, as Native American himself, Jamaica Highwater. And he consulted and said, no, he advised that you should generalize everything and make up fictional tribes, because no current tribe would want to be actively depicted like this in the future on a fictional show, which was total bunk. It's because, here we are in the 60s where no one was trying to be PC and have a Native American, consultant, and they weren't. So they were, but they still had this idea in the head of it's the future and everything. If the American culture, if the other Earth cultures had all merged, then this one would be too. And the fact that these were ancient, and they even said Amerinds, American Indians, if they had been lifted by, we get the preservers notion here, which comes back and may even linger through some of the upcoming current shows. But the preservers seeding their, cones around, which kind of leads into what the chase was about.
The classic McCoy line, I've always wondered why there were so many humanoid races scattered throughout the galaxy, which was, of course, a foreshadowing of Kirk's or Picard's exploration of that. Right. And indeed, say, the notion of Chakotay and his spirit guide, which again really starts to begin to investigate and analyze and provide that Native American trope to develop this. Let's talk characters, Larry, because obviously there are a number of key characters within this, including the Triumvirate, although Sam Cooke doesn't actually set foot on the bridge. That's all Spock and McCoy. But we do have Sabrina Scharf as Miramani. We have, of course, Rudy Solari as the very skeptical Salish, who, if only he'd actually known artificial respiration techniques, who knows, he could have actually saved the boy who was caught in the fisherman's nets, but he didn't, so there we went. Arguably, if he paid attention, his father had actually shown him the right guide to open up the obelisk, they wouldn't have had any need for Kirok in the first place, /Kirk. And, of course, the late Richard Hale as Goro, the tribal leader. Who for you actually stood out as being, that was a powerful performance. That's the one I'd give either honorable mentions to or a definite plus.
Well, I think you have to start off with Sabrina Scharf. I mean, and again, you're in a problematic time when you have white actors playing natives. At times, some of the extras, I think, some of the background extras, obviously, but having given, with the wig and the whole thing. But having said that, I think she, we think so badly of the third season. You were talking about this. This is early third season, and Bob Justman was still involved with the series, and it was still the carryover from second season, and people hadn't either jumped ship or just been exhausted by now, following Gene's example. And it's as much as there is to wince about. If you look at the glass half full, there's a lot going on here. Salish has kind of Rudy has kind of a thankless job. He's the aggrieved, bumped boyfriend, tribal elder who's been, who has everything, and he's in the right. Kirk is an imposter, or Kirok is an imposter. He has been usurped. He'll get his job back eventually, apparently. So that's, he does what he can with that, I feel like.
Although I think for me, the moment when he actually lost any sympathy was when he basically said to Miramani, go die with your false god. And they went in for the stoning, which, again, primitive cultures we've seen over the years, that is, Lord knows we can go back to the New Testament in terms of let the person who's without sin cast the first stone. So again, a sort of challenging line there.
Well, look, let's remember, this is 68, 69, and the fact that she is pregnant was just a concept that American television was getting liberal enough to be able to, you know, we talk about Lucille Ball and Desi Lu in Star Trek, and it had only been 15 years since Lucy was, her pregnancy was never mentioned, and it was a radical idea. Now, a lot had happened. We were only a year or two away from All in the Family being allowed to have a toilet flush and have the sound be heard. So that's where American television was. So on one hand, it's amazing that they're even making oblique references to her carrying his child. And I guess the stoning is kind of severe. But then again, if you can have large fake foam rocks, you can have small ones too. And if you look at it that way, if they're actually going to kill her at the end and wipe out that, there's no trace of a Kirk heir here, at least. Here's one time when there isn't. This sounds gross to say, but what's the neatest way you can have primitives, you know, they bloodied her just a little bit. They didn't want to destroy the beauty makeup here in this outdoor culture, but I guess it was like the neatest, cleanest way to have to accomplish the ends of the story, kill her and the baby and give her a death scene. You know,
it's certainly interesting. I think Mark Cushman, writing in These Are the Voyages, Volume 3, said, as well as obviously seeing the top albums of the time, Simon and Garfunkel's The Graduate Theme. And you could also go into the record department of Walgreens for $2.55. And whilst there, pick up a 12-gauge Remington Wingmaster pump-action shotgun for $75 with a box of 25 shotgun shells for $1.79. Yeah, we maybe haven't changed too much, sadly, from those days, basically, but so it goes.
Right.
I know you hate scores, and I appreciate that. I'm going to be very positive about this. It'd be interesting what the rest of the team make of this, because I know we're going to be joined by a number of key folk. Phil Leonis has already said he's got one or two issues with respect to, as we've said, the Native American representation and lines from that. But again, areas to be discussed. What are you going to go for? I mean, again, the director, I think 29 years of age when he took the role on board. Was bringing in scenes very much on time and under budget. 28, yes, he was 28 when he was actually there directing his first Star Trek. He'd been an actor with the Dr. Kildare series, worked on A Man Called Shenandoah and so on. So I think he certainly, given the location work, which I always appreciate location filming, because I think, they might have to do some dialogue looping, they might have to do some ADA, etc. But it's always got a slightly plus factor. Even if it's Vasquez Rocks, it kind of stands out slightly more than the studio setup.
Well, here, yes, definitely. You definitely get a different vibe. And I guess people maybe thought as they watched the early third season originally that this was going to be a harbinger. And aside from one little bit outdoors in All Our Yesterdays for the sword fight, this was the only location. You know, they're cutting back budgets constantly, and that's one of the easiest ways to do it. So this was the big location shoot of the year, and we've got, thanks to Billy Blackburn, who was I was calling Lieutenant Gooseneck, but he was Shatner's stand-in, and was around all 3 years of the series, very distinguished. But he would take his home movie camera out, and those have been on some of the DVD and Blu-ray sets, and we have a lot of footage from this show, and we have it's surfaced on YouTube, and I just had Andrea Weaver, who was the first, second and third seasons women costumer, who was there. I haven't published this, but I've had her watch. It's some of the faces we know, but three-fourths of them we don't. She watched his home movies that are up on YouTube now and identified people by name, by frame. So we've got another good record. But it's awesome. So it's awesome for that, but it's great because it is on location. The location, and we go there when I do, we have Trekline Treks here in Los Angeles of the locations when I take host people. That's Franklin Canyon Reservoir, which is an urban lake, one of the early Los Angeles, you know, attempts to have a reservoir. It's city drinking water. And it's also, we don't pan along it because we tend to see they beam in and pop up and the obelisk is there. And most of the camera angles are pretty static, aside from the ones they show across the lake where they've set up her village. But those are the same row of trees where Andy Griffith and Ronnie Howard walk on the opening credits for the Andy Griffith Show when the Happy Whistler and they're going fishing. That whole sequence is filmed along the road where for Star Trek, all the location trucks would have been parked. You know, we don't get to where Opie and Andy wind up and they skip the rocks, where they wind up is about where the obelisk is standing. So that's very cool. And it's easy for people to, and it's amazing to get there. It's why it's a location shot from the 60s onwards. It's right there at the top of, you're just in the ridge of the Hollywood Hills. And you'd never know standing there that you're in the middle of, you know, Los Angeles, but you are. And it's, and that's why it's a great location.
So your mark out of 10 then, Larry, given that this is, I think, one of only three episodes in which Christine Chappell actually beams down. I think the others would be What Are Little Girls Made Of, first season. Then, of course, the other one would be Plato's Stepchildren. I don't think she beamed down on any other occasions, unless I'm way off base on that one.
You're probably right. I haven't thought of it from that way, but you're exactly right. Well, I love because they've got their medical kit. You see some of the medical of all things, but that's where my eye goes. I'm just trying to think of some of the other bits here. I do like the detail of having Kirk with the sideburns just to show some passage of time. No, it's really, you know, they've recycled the remastered actually uses the main deflector the way Next Generation, it became such a trope on the, you know, to deflect the energy that's going to deflect the asteroid. It's a very sweet show, and yes, it's very easy for us to look at it in the eyes of modern, you know, our modern eyes and looking at how they're treating that, but it's one of the sweetest, it's one of the best death scenes. Edith Keeler didn't get a death scene.
Yeah, I think what sold the Edith Keeler, and I appreciate we haven't looked at City on the Edge of Forever yet, and it'll be some far in our future for Resonance Rewind, but I think what sold that as an impact was William Shatner's cutaway shot, his trembling hand as he kind of holds his hand to his mouth and basically realizes that, and of course the McCoy line, I could have saved her, Jim, you deliberately stopped me, why did you do this? And of course Leonard Nimoy's, he knows, Doctor, he knows, to the response of, do you know what you just did? I have a feeling you might be going for a 7 out of 10 for this, Larry. Is that on button, or are you going to go slightly higher or slightly lower?
Yes, I don't like, unless they're really obvious, I don't like rating shows. There's a piece of me these days that wants to push back on the well-intended harshness of modern eyes looking at episodes like this. So with all those caveats, I'm also pushing back against the meme about Kirk being the womanizer. And this is one of the, and the fact that he's been liberated from his everyday persona. And this is, you know, his unconscious set free. I might, and I know for years, this was a favorite of a lot of the fan fiction writers that wanted to, you know, do a follow up.
Well, you got a bare William Shatner torso. You also got a fly that effectively sort of takes up residence on his cheek in a very emotive scene.
That's right. No time for retakes. I will give this an 8. And one more story real quick. Production, because I barely got this. I don't think this is recorded anywhere else. And it happened on a happenstance call with Bob Justman just shortly before he died. He was telling me that in this episode, when we had the shot of her village across the lake, they went all out. They rented all the, you know, the token Indian things, and they had canoes, right? So they got to the location. He's back at the studio, but the location folks are setting up, and there's city people there supervising because it was a city water lake, municipal water lake. And he got a frantic call from his set people who said, they won't let us put the canoes that we rented in the water because it's drinking water. And he said, and if you watch the episode, you'll see this. He said, well, then put them up on the land like they're being dried out. He says, we paid for those suckers, and they're going to be in the shot. So that's why when you see that, you'll see the canoes like artfully put on the beach, like they're just being, you know, dried and cleaned.
The music of Gerald Fries there and the haunting Miramani theme. So we've heard what Larry Namicek thinks about this particular episode of Star Trek. Let's turn to somebody who has actually said she's not a Trek fan, but she's going to give this a try. It is, of course, our ace singer-songwriter extraordinaire, Victoria Simmons. How are you, Victoria?
I'm very well. A little hot, but very well.
Well, it's not as hot as France, I think, but there we are.
It's on a par.
Is it? Well, there we are. You've obviously brought the sunshine with you. But let's talk the Paradise Syndrome. Your thoughts, please.
I enjoyed it. I actually remember watching Star Trek when I was younger. I mean, I'm not a Star Trek fan or a Star Wars fan, like I know many people are, but I do remember watching it. And I always remember going, really, I was about 7 and thinking that William Shatner was really handsome.
Well, he was, and arguably still is at 90.
Yes, I don't think a 7-year-old should be thinking that, but that's beside the point.
I mean, let's not go there, but in terms of, say, the way the narrative developed, because I know you're a keen Doctor Who fan, and I think we can have a galaxy in which we work together and collectively. How did you make of this portrayal of the Native Americans? And, of course, the only episode of the original series of Star Trek, which actually takes place over a 3-month period. So you see, obviously, the development of Kirk falling in love and the paradise aspect and really arguably the one true love of his life, if you take out Edith Keeler and a few other folk. Anyway, Victoria.
I thought that it was a nice change to something that would otherwise be in the galaxy with the stars and some potential aliens and destruction. And saving that, yes, you did have the destruction, but there was that element of humanity in it. And then, of course, someone stepping up to the mark because somebody else wasn't there. Can I say touching? It's not quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
Even when I watched this as an undergraduate student, actually, it still gave me goosebumps and a momentary peak at the end where, obviously, Miramani passes and so on. Let's turn to our newbie on the programme today as a programme leader for sports journalism at the University of Lincoln, ace a supporter of Barnsley Football Club. His name is indeed Ian Barnsley. Ian Barnsley, how are you? And welcome to Residence Rewind.
Yeah, can you hear me all right?
Of course we can, Ian. We have total faith.
I don't use Zoom very much, but that's good.
What were your thoughts on this particular episode? Because I believe you've watched it twice.
I think I watched it about 5 times, but I might have nodded off a few times while I was watching them, I'm afraid, at the time of night I was watching it.
Ian's momentarily frozen on that particular side of things, but never mind. I'm sure we'll actually get him back in the Zoom before too long, and hopefully we'll connect together as we await the arrival of Jessica Burtis, who should be with us as well, and indeed is entering the room now. Yeah, we just sort of froze momentarily there. We had a slight hiccup from that point of view. And indeed, Phil Lear is already actually holding up a superb album cover for the system. Jessica, let's turn to you. We got part of your thing there from the perspective of the system there. Let's talk, Jessica Burtis, initially. What did you make of this saga of the whole sequence and, indeed, the Paradise Syndrome?
So my initial thoughts, I think that it's very much, you can tell it was definitely made in the 60s. I think that it doesn't come across well in a lot of aspects of the episode. I think the romance also is not something that I really liked at all for many reasons. It was interesting hearing Larry Nemechek's thoughts on the romance throughout the different shows and its perception. That was really interesting. But I think that there were a couple good points, especially in the kind of the overall plot with the idea of a crew having to save a planet from an asteroid and things like that. I think that's very interesting. But yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about the rest of it.
Interesting. We might actually have one of those rare occasions where we agree to differ on this one, Jessica, because I tend to echo one of the thoughts of an IMDb reviewer who actually said one of the best episodes in season 3, a much underrated, almost dreamlike episode. Let's turn to Phil Leonis. Phil, again, I think like Jessica, I deliberately didn't send this pre-record to Ian or Victoria because I wanted the initial thoughts on that. But what were your thoughts on this scenario? And I see you've actually changed your name to Phil to I Am Kirok.
Yes. So the episode does begin and end for me with the music. One of the best scores on television in the 1960s. So good that the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra did a vinyl record recording of the soundtrack to, let's remember, a failed show. A show that was failing in the ratings, but the music was so hailed and acclaimed. And truly, when I say begin and end, we hear that opening piece when they're on the planet there, and it kind of gives us hope of, oh, this is something different than what we've had before. And certainly that ending with the credits coming over and the music and Shatner ultimately having no Shatnerisms left. And just having to sit in the pain of it is profound, and it's profoundly different for this show. I think any to say that it's one of the best episodes of season three, there's a way of looking at that's damning with faint praise, because the context, as Jessica said, is of the 60s and how we view these things, but it's also a context of Star Trek in season three versus other seasons. The network wanted rid of it, slashed the budgets, could not be seen as killing off the show because of the massive letter writing campaign. This was not an era where we valued demographics, so they didn't quite understand that having a lot of young, educated people watching a show was
like Jessica and Victoria.
Was a powerful demographic. They just looked at sheer numbers. And so they slashed the budget for season three, and we see it in respects in this episode. For example, just a simple line of, well, we've had all these search parties looking for the captain. Well, wait a minute, did you? I don't see anyone on that planet. I just still see Spock and McCoy all episode long bickering with each other. We see from a distance this native settlement. But once we're there, boy, we only see like three or four people. There's no money for anything. But again, boy, the music really helps tell this story and elevate this story. It works as radio play. And I don't mean that as a joke, because in the tradition of Star Trek at its best, it works as radio play.
Ian, we were cut off in mid-sentence, I think, with your own thoughts of the whole thing. You've heard some of the views of Jessica and Phil and Victoria now. Anything you'd like to add, given, as I say, that probably like myself, you watched it initially many years ago and then kind of rewatched it now for this particular show?
I think I must have seen it many years ago, but I don't remember seeing it. I've watched all the series, but it was that long ago and it was refreshing to watch it again, actually. Although I did worry at the beginning when it started off on a planet like Earth. I always get a bit worried when Star Trek episodes start off on a planet like that. But it was enjoyable, and I followed it all well. And I thought the ending was very, very good as well. I thought that it was poignant.
I love what Ian said about the Earth-like planet. I mean, there's that funny exchange at the beginning where they're talking about how the growth and everything is so Earth-like, and they literally say, what are the odds? Well, by season three, the odds are really good because we don't have any money to create anything that doesn't look Earth-like. We're either on an empty Enterprise or on a planet that looks just like Earth, but at least this is one case where hand it to the writers. They certainly made an effort of turning a potential weakness into a strength, into a point of this idea of, oh, wow, maybe the reason there are so many humanoid-like cultures out is because there was an advanced race that was seeding planets so that different species or different iterations or different expressions of humanity would have a chance to survive. And that's a fun science fiction concept, I think.
And certainly, I think kudos to Margaret Armon, who actually did a good job in terms of this. I mean, it was one of her early writing things. She'd go on to write for Wonder Woman, for $6 Million Man, for Bionic Woman, and various other things. Good jobbing TV writer, I think, who developed some interesting themes as far as that's concerned. Victoria, any additional thoughts you'd like to put to the team in terms of how the thing unveiled? And as I say, was it better than you expected? Was it worse? Was it a case of never ask me to watch Star Trek again? Was it a Zardoz moment for you?
No, it wasn't that bad. No, not at all. Actually, it reminded me of why I liked watching it in the first place, because it was almost like, because I was such a fan of Thunderbirds at the same time, it was almost as though I was watching the same style of TV, but with actual people, so I could resonate a little bit more with it. But you have to remember, I was 7, 8 at the time that I was watching this.
And in love with William Shatner.
Yeah, and I was really upset when he was replaced, so I stopped watching. But I totally agree about the music. The music is always always really good on this one. But I would have, because they made such a point of the code being about music, they could have made a little bit more of that point. And not just being his phrasing of saying his name, or Scotty, beam me up, whatever he says. And that could have been made into something more.
Well, it's interesting. There's a Strange New Worlds episode that maybe Larry Nemechek spoke about. I did not get a chance to listen, but there's a Strange New Worlds episode, which is a current prequel to this original series. And they encounter another obelisk that is ostensibly from this same race, Alex. I don't know if that's ever established, but it too, you know, is a defense system for a planet, and all the notes are musical. And even if it's not, quote unquote, the same species and the same codes, certainly the records of that mission would have been in this Enterprise's computers for Spock to realize, instead of 58 days into the 59 days he has to figure it out, maybe just a cursory glance through the computer databanks would show, oh, obelisks, musical symbols. And he might have been working on that angle. That's where, man, we start to get trapped. And I understand no one likes a sci-fi geek, but we're in the same universe, supposedly. And wow, we just threw this episode under the bus because of a new episode.
Well, I think it's an interesting, because of course, Ian, you are watching Star Trek Strange New Worlds. And again, that's got an interesting perspective. Again, that whole notion of how the saga continues. I'm still, it's an aside, but I'm still confused by how luxurious Captain Pike's quarters actually are in Strange New Worlds.
I mean, it's very like comfortable in there. I think we'd all be very comfortable if we had a quarters like that.
It's a palatial suite. I mean, Kirk's sort of dormitory bed, by comparison, it's almost as though he's had a sort of a trip downwards.
With a working kitchen and burners that flame, what could go wrong? In we're going down too many rabbit holes that don't involve the brilliance of Shatner being Shatner, which is such a hallmark of season three. Again, it is almost astonishing, because I feel like, to a degree, this Shatner we're seeing is the Shatner we think of. And we don't think of the Shatner who was in the first half of season one, who was actually a rather subtle actor. He becomes a big star almost in spite of the subtle, well-trained actor he actually was. And I love him. I'm not criticizing one way or another. But it is interesting that what you see in the efforts and the performance that Shatner gives, he amps it up more and more and more the more the series is failing in the ratings. And there's something almost noble about that, that instead of trying to get off a sinking ship, he's working harder to try to make this work. And boy, we see that in this episode a lot. There's a lot of Shatner. But also in context, fascinating. One of the things I'm sure that Jessica had a problem with, I certainly did, you know, the idea of the white god in the native lore, that's a little uncomfortable. But of course, this is a white god in William Shatner, who was literally on screen playing Comanche Indian twin brothers that very year in the movie White Comanche. So as we take in Star Trek, and we realize from our modern lens, ooh, that's uncomfortable. We also have to doff our cap a little bit and say, but you know what? It was better at dealing with these things than much of its contemporaries were.
And indeed, the title change to the Paradise Syndrome as opposed to the Pale Face, which was the original working title of the episode. Again, I think a sensible decision, shall we say. Jessica, you've heard some of the team there. Has that kind of made you think again a little bit? I mean, are you sort of considering, I mean, let's talk favourite characters. Are you going to go for Sabrina Scharf's Miramani? Are you going to go for Medicine Chief Salish? Are you possibly going to go for the poor wee bairns of and Montgomery Scott's engines who are basically being reduced to a puddle of lead?
So I think that actually the doctor, is it McCoy? He's often my favorite character because he just is so chill. Like every time he's on screen, which he was only there for like 2 minutes, but every time he's on screen, it just feels like so safe. He just seems like a really sweet character.
And yet he's so mean. At one point he gets so mean in this.
He's just honest.
He's honest, but they don't do him any favors, Jessica, because he gets so mean. He says, you took your chance. You blew it. Everything is your fault. Cut to the very next scene. He comes in and says, we all blamed you. We were wrong. Don't blame yourself. And it was like, wow. I mean, couldn't we just separate out those scenes a little bit? Dr. McCoy just seems crazy all of a sudden.
You know, it's one of the more like quirky characters. I think he's so interesting. I just want to know more about him. But no, I feel like Miramani was actually, I don't like how she was portrayed at all. I think like those saying with the how the one white guy that shows up is like a god. And then she's like, I have to marry him. And it's like her cut, like the custom where she has to marry him. So then the whole romance doesn't feel real to me because it's like she is with him because of the obligation of being him being perceived as a god. So then I don't know. I'm like, why is he okay with this, comfortable with this, how she kind of feels like she has to be with him? I mean, I get that it's like, oh, she falls in love with him, but like.
Given the choice between Kirk or Salish, who effectively said, go die with your false god before he stones her to death, you know, it was a tough call. Toxic masculinity at its worst, really.
Wow, that's the thing, right? They set up that, oh, these are tribes that were the most developed and the most peace-like. We already have expressed a little bit of a pejorative view of native tribes right there. We understand now, I like to think that there was plenty of evidence to understand then that Native tribes had quite a strong matriarchal influence running through them. But boy, she is introduced from the very beginning as nothing but an object. The way she's walking up those steps, the way that she's filmed beneath him. One could argue that, yes, they're trying to establish Kirk as elevated. But when you do that, you are, whether intentionally or not, subjugating another character. And I know I'm taking, again, things that are out of the context within the TV frame, but I think you have to, looking back at the, that's why we do Resonance Rewind. And you cast not only a white actress, of course, but Sabrina Scharf, who was a Playboy bunny. And before being a Playboy bunny, was someone who at 15 eloped with her algebra teacher. So this is baggage that informs certainly how an actor would respond. Because in the hands of another performer, it maybe gets played different. We don't have the same effect, even as written, because actors do become the caretakers for their characters. It's not the writer anymore once the actor starts to embody it. And maybe different choices could have been made by an actor in conjunction with the directors that could have left us with a feeling of a little more empowerment that might have made us think, oh, we're watching an actual culture versus some masculine fantasy of a culture. Yeah. And when Star Trek feels masculine fantasy, that's when I feel that it's failing us.
And of course, as we said, Margaret Armand's other Star Trek episode introduced the world to Angelique Pettijohn's Shana in The Gamesters of Triskelion. Somebody else who, again, had interesting sort of lines. Okay, Victoria, your favourite character. We've already had a vote for Dr. McCoy. Where are you going to go?
Oh, that's tough.
Is it going to be the inner seven-year-old who will say it has to be William Shatner as James T. Kirk?
Yeah, maybe. No, I'm not sure whether it's not my favorite character, but I would like to have seen more of the anger, first of all, in I can't remember his name, the guy that used to be the medicine man and
Salish.
Salish, okay.
Played by Rudy Solari.
I'd have liked to see more of the anger between him and Kirk, because you're being taken away from something that was your whole life and somebody given to something else. And I think maybe there could have been more of a reaction on his part to all of that happening, rather than just a few, you get a few sort of shots of going into his face and he's apparently angry, but
he's very angry. He's furious.
It didn't quite come off, I think, as much as it could have done, but otherwise, no, I quite like Scotty.
Ian Barnsley, is it going to be a vote for Richard Hale as the Indian chief Goro, who obviously named Kirok, that's what we want to call you, or are you going somewhere else?
I'm going somewhere else. I'm going with the paramedic. Did you spot the paramedic who did the CPR?
Are we?
Captain Kirk.
Oof.
Did you see the CPR? I was, what's going on there? Kiss of life. And then what was he doing with the legs? I'd never seen anything like that. That was the thing. And that was the kind of stuff that McCoy would have liked to have done. But of course, he wasn't there to do it, was he? So he was back on the ship. Although I think did like McCoy and Spock's what they shared and the anger between McCoy at Spock's aloof decision making and then not thinking about the consequences for Captain Kirk.
Well, the anger and also the subsequent care, as Phil actually alluded to, the notion, and again, I identified this with somebody who was often told that I was too obsessed with the work, too obsessed with the essay writing, needed to take time out. And I would actually use this as, in a sense, an example whereby, yes, my parents would say, you need to rest, lie down. No, I'd rest for a moment, then I'd get up and I'd go to the thing and I'd continue with the essay writing and work through that process in through the whole system. So it kind of did connect with me. And Phil, how about yourself in terms of the ensemble we have here? Or would it be the obelisk?
No, for me, that's, it truly is a character because it's representative of the species. That's a good one. I would be all right with that. But for me, what works best about this episode involves the ongoing arc and dynamic between how Spock and Kirk need each other to maintain their emotional sanity. This is Paradise Syndrome, and what Kirk goes through is a callback all the way to one of the best episodes, Naked Time, where Kirk reveals to Spock this dream that he has, but will never fulfill, of never having a beach to walk on. He'll never get to be happy. And we have seen Kirk lose love before, have to watch the woman that he loves, the arguably the love of his life, die. And so it's a really interesting, almost third act iteration of this concept. And he needs Spock to center him again, to remind him who he is, which is a role that has been flipped going all the way back to Naked Time, where instead of a mind meld, it's Kirk getting, bringing Spock back in. Was it This Side of Paradise, Alex? Yeah. Where finally, for the first time, as Spock says, for the first time in my life, I was happy. And Kirk has to rescue him from his own happiness. So it is, in the mythos of Star Trek, it is a very worthy episode in terms of the exploration of the psychology and the needs between these two men.
And as we said in the discussion with Larry, This Side of Paradise is in many ways a companion piece to this, because in This Side of Paradise, the entire Enterprise crew go off on a happy journey to paradise, leaving Kirk by himself. In this time, it's Kirk who is the solitary entry and exiter from paradise. Let's go numbers then, Ian. This is the time where we effectively look to do a quantitative analysis to the qualitative. What score would you give The Paradise Syndrome?
Six.
Six from Ian. Okay,
are we out Victoria. Of 10? Are we out of 10?
It is out of 10, yes. That's
six
the thing.
Out so, of 10.
Six. And Victoria?
No, I'm
going to
go 7.
Mm. Larry Nemechek went 8. I might even push it to an 8.5, maybe even a 9, but, that might be pushing it. Phil?
I want to go 8. What I like about this is very good. And I mean, I could go on and on. The zooms, the use of zooms in this, technically so fascinating. There are so many different elements, like I told you about, with the character psychology, with the music, with how they tried to turn weaknesses into strengths. I want to give it an 8. But the older I get, the more that what doesn't work really troubles me. The stoning of the woman that we talk about, but also there's at no point, clearly, do any of the storytellers care about her. Not just with what they overtly do to her, but what they don't do. It doesn't occur to anyone that when McCoy beams down, he should maybe look at a woman who's laying there prone. Instead, he goes straight to his captain and has to be told by the captain, do what you can for her. McCoy hasn't even thought there's a woman lying there ostensibly dying, and he doesn't look at her, and no director stands up and says, shouldn't someone care about the woman? That really that really bothers me. I mean, again, we talk about male fantasy. We're used to Star Trek. We're not surprised when Christine Chapel comes down in all that wind and cold, but they don't think to put long pants on her. No, we have to stay with the miniskirt. Okay, we're used to that. We get that. But boy, the just ignoring of a woman's pain, not only on screen, but on the part of the people making the episode, does not sit well with me. So a 6.
And Jessica, are you going to take on the curmudgeonly role this week, which should be a mirror universe, Jessica, as far as we're concerned?
I know. I think I'm going to have to play that role because it's just what I'm thinking. I know Roland Barthes says, you know, like, separate the death of the author, the context, but I kind of like Jeanette's whole idea of the context. So the context of this made in 1966 is that it came 2 years before the I was looking it up, the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968, which basically was the federal government recognizing free speech and freedom from
protection. This show was actually year. Shot in 1968.
Okay, it's worse, yes. Jessica, it's the same year.
It's worse, the same okay, year. Yeah. Literally, that law basically was the federal government recognizing that Indigenous people in the U.S. have the rights to free speech and protection from cruel and unusual punishment, among other basic rights. So it's really not the context, and especially with Miramani, how Indigenous women in the U.S. are 2.5 times more likely to face physical violence than any other racial demographic. It really doesn't come across well, and I hated the romance. I'm sorry, I hated it. But I think the saving grace for me for this episode was that the idea of somebody like losing their memories and having to join someone new, is there someone different, and like they're getting flashbacks in their dreams, that's pretty cool. I like that. That was interesting. And the idea of like someone leaving obelisks on different planets, and it's like, ooh, I thought that was interesting. But the context was really hard for me to like, because the context informed so much of the characterization of this show, that I kind of had a hard time with it. So 3 for me. I'm sorry.
Well,
Alex, one of the things, if I just have a moment, why I love the concept of Resonance Rewind itself is that, again, it elevates all of this work out of either the determination of is it good or is it bad? If it's good, we'll keep it. If it's bad, we'll get rid of it, because we're able to breathe new life into conversations that are ongoing. And one of them that I think this episode brings up is this idea that in cultures where you do not have a respect of women, you also will never have respect of Indigenous cultures, that racism and misogyny go hand in hand historically.
Interesting times. We certainly thank Ian Barnsley, Victoria Simmons, Phil Leonis, and of course Jessica Burtis and Larry Nemechek for his earlier substantive contribution to the program. Next week, there are those here who believe that life here began out there. The opening prologue to, of course, part 1 and part 2 of the Glenn Larson directed and produced Battlestar Galactica 1978 series, which I think, Ian, you're keen to obviously access from that point of view. Phil, hopefully be with us again. We'll also be joined by Professor Fiona Moore, who's written, of course, the text By Your Command, which analyzes the whole piece. Victoria, ever encountered Battlestar Galactica before?
No. Obviously well, heard of it, but never watched it.
Well, there we are. It's 1978's edition, not the remake in 2001. That's for another time. And Jessica, likewise, one possibly your parents have encountered, but ever heard of Battlestar Galactica with Lorne Greene, Richard Hatch, Maren Jensen, Jane Seymour, and many more.
Dirk Benedict. Isn't it Dirk Benedict?
Dirk Benedict, yes.
Yeah, heard of it, never watched it, so I'm excited to finally understand what the hype is all about.
Well, until then.
There's no hype, Jessica. The hype is for the 2001 remake. There's no hype at all about. But, oh, wait, I'm spoiler alert. Okay.
Who knows where we'll be going with respect to that lost tribe of mankind seeking, of course, the planet Earth. For now, though, keep on resonating.
We will live long and happy lives.
Makes me want to live.